Laughing Eyes Kennel presents The Gypsy Musher with Iditarod and Yukon Quest veteran Hugh Neff. The Gypsy Musher will share stories from the trail, fortune-telling, and memories of mushing years past. Follow The Gypsy Musher on Twitter and visit our website at gypsymusher.com.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto sitting in the house of Hugh Neff, the Gypsy Musher, sitting here with Jewel, Amigo, and
George Costanza.
George. Hugh, how's it going? What's happening?
Good, man. How was your morning so far?
Awesome run together?
Yeah. Nothing like being on a sled in October, is there?
I know. You guys have a little bit of snow here, what, 3-4 inches at least?
Oh, well, the way I look at it, it's a lot more than we had on the Iditarod Trail last year, so as long as you know your team and know the trail and have a lot of weight in the sled and have trees you can hook off to with your hook, I see no problem. I despise actually four-wheeler training. I don't really like to be on a four-wheeler. Some people have to do it, but once you're on a sled, then you really feel the magic, I think, a lot more.
And being the first time I've ever been on the trails here in Tokyo, you guys have a nice system here.
Yeah, Dale Probert, old big-time sprint musher from the area, put it in. We call it Dale's Trail. It goes to Tanacross. It's got lots of loops that jut off the trail, so we can have different, like, 7-miler like we just did. The next team I'm going to run here in a little bit, I can run 15. Then we got to Tanacross and back's about 23. So plenty of trails. And then it gets a little bit colder, I can do 50s early November on the Eagle Trail. And when I do the big trips, we're, of course, going to truck them up to the Taylor Highway. And this year, December, we're actually going to get a bunch of people together and a couple of snow machines and have a big party. And hopefully, once everything is taken care of, notifying the border, I've talked with some Border Patrol people, we're going to do a run to Dawson City for Christmas.
So how does that work? When you guys go over the border on a trail, how does that work? How do they even know you cross?
Well, sled tracks, probably.
I mean, is somebody actually standing there? Like,
No, they're shut down out there, that part of the Top of the World Highway this time of year. So you notify, I've already talked to the guys on the American side, and I just got to call folks in Whitehorse and have them notify people in Dawson. Just like the Quest, you get to Dawson, you
go through customs and all that?
No, they know you're there.
They know you're there.
But for smaller races, you have to go and check in, let them know you're
there. So the law are in the law even on the sled dog trail?
Oh, yeah. They'll fly up Border Patrol guys to Eagle, and they go through our passports and sometimes our paperwork.
So you just got back from your European trip, about a week and a half ago?
Yeah, man, and I was just, just lucky, lucky, lucky. I mean, I get back here and 6-7 inches of fresh snow, temps, skies are clearing, temps are getting nice and cold. I just laughed and put the four-wheeler away and pulled up the sled and been on the sled ever since.
So how was the trip? We haven't talked since you've been back on your show. What did you see? Who did you visit with? And what was the experience like?
Just amazing. Maggie Brooks, my neighbor here, was the chauffeur for the Germany part of the trip, and did a talk outside of Wolfsburg. It was at a weekend-long symposium they had there out next to a farm field. They're having a little contest, and people were taking their dogs for walks, primarily Siberian Malamute people, some Huskies. Did a school show up in the eastern part of Germany as well. Met a lot of friends in Frankfurt from all over, German fan club folks. And then it was neat because every year, I like to do something different. This year I got to go to Netherlands and hang out with Wim and John, Bert John, and they're just classic guys. They bought me some Dutch wooden shoes, that you see, and I got to see some windmills. Lots of people turned out for that one. It was cool. It was in like an old World War II bunker.
Wow.
They turned into like a bar lodge. Then from there, Walter and I jumped on the ferry, and we have to realize that I am the showboat, but he is the star. I do the yapping, but people really were getting off on seeing Walter more than anything. And we jumped on a ferry from there and went up to England, and that was just awesome. The people up there were great. Got to see Sherwood Forest. Even for that show that we did in a place called the Midlands, which is in the central part of England, they had security guys for me, which I thought was pretty funny. Even though the security guys ended up razzing me during the presentation. And one of the fellows was a big guy from England that played football in Philadelphia, though.
Huh.
And he and his wife run Siberians.
Cool.
So that was cool. TJ's his name. And then from there, after being in England for a few days, I came back through Luxembourg and met some really cool people. Frank and his wife and my good friend Chris Wammer came to Luxembourg, and we did a show there on a Sunday. And so we did, six shows total.
Wow.
And it was tiring, very tiring. Then it took another week just to get, reaccustomed to the time here and everything. But the interesting part was when we flew back from Frankfurt, there's a kid in line that stares at me, and he's got a big smile on his face. And I'm like, who do you work with? Because I could tell he's a musher because he recognized me. And he actually worked with my buddy Mats Petersen in Kiruna, Sweden, doing tours. So the Swiss guy was coming here to visit for a little bit. Rito is his name, and Rito actually stayed and hung out with me for a few days and ran dogs. So
it's a small world in the mushing world.
It is, and even when I got on the flight in Anchorage, I remember there's an older German guy, probably late 70s or 80, and he walks up to me and he goes, "Hugh Neff, I was just watching you on TV last week in Germany," because they had shown a documentary that they did on the Quest many years ago.
So I know you've said that the Quest is big in Germany. What about those other countries like England and Holland? Where are they getting their information from? Facebook?
Oh, the internet, everything,
Is there a following like there is in Germany with the bigger races?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, big time, big time. In fact, as people found out that I was there, I think they wanted me to stay a little bit longer. But, I've got to get back here and run dogs. But next year, the game plan is hopefully the same countries, but I really, I'm a diehard, Scottish boy at heart. I want to be up and see where Wallace used to play around and maybe possibly even go to Ireland. England, I didn't really know that much about, but it's quite beautiful. Fairly crowded, but, it's just an island. But people don't realize, I always talk about being German, but they don't realize that that's my dad's side of the family. I'm also Dutch, French, and Irish, so that's my mom's side of the family. That's where I get the crazy Hugh Neff from.
There you go.
But it's funny, good story. My older brother Bruce, 10 years older than me, I think I told you this last night. As a kid, my nickname was Twans, and when they were whitewashing me with snow or beating up on the little brother, because I was the little brother in the family, they'd always say Twans or whatever. So I'm signing one of my books for a guy in the Netherlands, outside of Rotterdam, and I always ask the person, "What's your name?" so I could write hello to them in the book when I sign it. And the guy goes, "My name's Twan." And, I'm part Dutch, so it was just like, wow.
Wow, that connection.
There's meaning to that.
Yeah, very cool.
That was pretty cool.
So what does Twans mean? Do you know?
He who stands still little.
That describes you to a T.
You see me running around here, man.
Yeah, I do.
Not only do I drink a lot of coffee, but you see the passion I have for what I do. And I get, critiqued by the professional mushers, but I guarantee you none of them put in a day like I do every day.
Well, that's interesting. I think in the next coming months we're going to have a few shows about those so-called critiques.
Yeah, I think I don't personally feel like I want to do this, but I think I need to do this. And not for me, but just there are a few particular people that have been, shall we say, negative-minded towards their fellow competitors, and if they aren't called out for the bullies that they are, they're going to continue to do this, because it was my turn last year, but the same guy was yelling at people, Jake Berkowitz, a friend of mine, the year before, while he was actually an official during the Quest, and had a very animated discussion about this in the Mushroom meeting. So people need to be called out for, if I don't talk more about who I am and what I'm about, those that are listening that are on the internet world aren't going to realize the whole story, the big picture, and that this guy that wanted to rip into me after I nearly died, this guy decides to tell the world that I'm this horrible person. I don't despise him, and I don't hate him. I feel sorry for him, because people who know the history of the Quest know that he goes around saying that he's won the Quest, and he never won the Quest. He was given the Quest one year when I was given a penalty for going down the wrong trail, the road next to the trail, and I ended up losing that race to this fellow by 4 minutes. And the funny thing was, he was behind us by hours at that time, and he told people that he went down the same trail that I went down, but he didn't get his spelling. So he has to live with that, and I think that hurts them, and maybe he's just trying to take it out on me. His last race, in fact, was the Iditarod, and if you look in the history of the Iditarod, the person right in front of him, his last race was me. So I think he has wants to put me in his place.
But, you know, a little bit of this is clear in your mind as well. I know we talked about that last night, kind of getting it off your mind.
Well, everything, move on, you
yeah,
know?
Everything that happened last night.
If you keep things, inside, it's just going to fester and boil and get worse. So you got to let it out. And if people want to critique me about doing this, I know what I've got to improve on. I know I've got to have crampons and be set up for whatever Iditarod's going to throw at us, because I think we all realized after last year that we are at the will of the Iditarod people, and as mushers, they know that we're going to do this race because we love this race. We love this trail. But it's their baby, it's their mothership, and they're going to do what's best for them, and if that means they're going to put us on a trail that we shouldn't be on, we're still going to do it.
It sounds uniquely like another big sports league here in America, doesn't it?
Well, maybe it's just not the sport, but it's just the evolution of mankind and the internet.
Yes.
I mean, we were talking about Adrian Peterson last night, and, you know, he's obviously done some dumb things this week and in his life, and we all have, but I was spanked by my father when I was a kid. I don't believe in what he did to his children. That was a little bit too much, but this whole notion of being holier than thou, of being better than others, whether it's in politics or in dog mushing, I find revolting. And you see it not only on the internet, but you see it with a lot of youth. I have these young kid mushers that, you know, I've done more in a year than they've done mushing in their life, and they're trying to critique me about what's wrong with me. And when I saw some of that stuff on the internet last year, I was just sort of, I giggled at it because I'm like, boy, these kids are definitely not their fathers.
So as you can tell, folks that are listening, it's going to be a very interesting couple of months here on the Gypsy Musher Show. I think that we're going to get into a few topics that we haven't talked about before. Usually it's what he's doing, what he's about, where he's going, but we're going to talk a little bit about kind of the politics of mushing, I guess, in the next few episodes.
And it's not for any vendetta. People have to realize that, and the problem with dog mushing is if you cover stuff up, the video I saw of this year's Iditarod race is not the race that I was a part of. That was like the Iditarod video for all the races put together and just a little bit about
the reality show version of Iditarod.
Yeah, I think as all these races, and that's what I like about the Quest does get political, and it makes the papers, but it's good for the race because it grows. What the Quest is doing this year, stretching out the mandatory rests, I think is a great idea, and maybe hopefully down the road the Iditarod will learn for it. But maybe the Iditarod doesn't want to evolve in that direction. People fear it's going to turn into a stage race. But I think at heart, these races all have to be about what's best for the dogs. And if there's, like my idea was to have a mandatory floating four that the mushers had to take on the coast somewhere, either Koya, Shaktulik, or Elam.
So for folks that don't know what that means, why would that benefit the teams or the dogs to have that floating four on the coast?
I think it's keeping the competitive human testosterone overloaded mushers in their place, because this race is just, you know, humans are just going to keep pushing it, and everybody's so driven to win and be the king of the mountain and all that sort of stuff that they have to look at the beauty of this sport more than the competition of the sport. And is it better to have a faster race every year, or is it better to have more teams finish with beautiful-looking dogs? And
well, at some point, you're going to get to the point where you can't get much faster.
Yeah, let's hope so.
You know,
we're definitely pushing it to the limit. It's like I tell people, Hans Gott, Lance Mackey, they both won the Yukon Quest four times each. I've only won the Yukon Quest one time each. But out of the top 10 fastest times ever in the Yukon Quest, I have five of them. And that's just because of the last few years. You know, with Alan Moore pushing it, and Brent, of course, and myself. I mean, we're all feeding off each other's energy, and that's why it's good to have the checks and balances where the officials have deemed it more prudent for the Quest, instead of having 36 in Dawson, to spread it out a little bit. I think it's going to make it a much more enjoyable race to watch for fans because they don't know where we're going to take these mandatories. And it's I think it makes it more thrilling, actually.
So with that, now it's a 24 in Dawson?
Yeah.
And then what else is it? 12s or what is it?
I can't be specific with that. I don't have the rules in front of me right now, but I think you have some mandatory 6 in Eagle, and then you have your choice of a mandatory 6 in either Central, Circle, or 101, I believe. I'm not positive on that, though.
And in this year, that's going to be on the finishing side of the race.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's you're gonna have more rest tour, because that was a problem last year, and with Brent in particular, was the lack of rest towards the end.
Well, that's part of racing.
Well, right? so now
even Brent doesn't really know what happened there. I mean, he could have hit something. Who knows?
But now, when you have that mandatory rest towards the end, as you mentioned with Iditarod, it changes strategy a little bit in terms of finishing strategy. If you know that you have to rest 6 hours as a mandatory here or there, you're going to change up your strategy a little bit towards the end, aren't you?
Well, that's why you don't make it you have to stay 6 at this place.
Yeah.
You can give 3 different villages, and so you get your choice of one of those 3.
Okay.
It might be a little bit more work for the people in charge as far as keeping, you know, stats and all that, but with the internet these days, it can't be that difficult.
Right.
In fact, it'd be nice to see these races one day where we pull into checkpoints and they've got, you know, digital leaderboards up like they have for golf or what have you. There's got to be some computer company that would love to have their logo above a big screen at every checkpoint. I think that'd be really neat for the race.
Well, I think they're trying that with what Iditarod's doing with their trackers. I know that the Mushers don't necessarily care for the trackers.
I mean, they're telling people that I turned off my tracker, which is, I mean, first of all, how would they even know that I did that? And I wouldn't even know how to do that. What I found out was that the cheaper version of the tracker that they used this year, they used a different tracker. And I found out that there's 2 buttons. There's an SOS button, then there's another button. I learned this when they gave us explicit directions at the Cobuk 440 in April. And the 2 hands on that tracker are the ones you're supposed to push, not the SOS button.
Right. And that's supposed to say, I'm okay, but here's my location, versus send out the cavalry when you press the SOS.
Yeah, but after last year, I'll never push one of those things again.
So with that, I know that you're usually on the other side of the tracker. There's always the controversy behind the trackers and how well that they work, at least from a fan perspective.
I heard they were pretty bad this year at the start of the race.
And they worked their way out. And I know that they tested the new system they used on Iditarod, on Junior Iditarod. And, of course, it always seems to be the same people doing all the complaining, especially on the Internet. It's the same handful of folks. But when you talk about how to track the race and how to make it more specific in terms of leaderboards, I think that's the way of the future.
Yeah, I don't mind people complaining from the heart, but we don't need medreds out there that are just all negative and anti-Alaskan, in my perspective. We need people that are doing this because they want to see it done better, not because they're telling the volunteers or whatever, hey, you're doing a bad job, you shouldn't be here, blah, blah, blah. We need people that are saying, hey, why don't you try doing it this way, or is there anything I can do to help? Too many, as they say, chiefs and not enough
Indians. Yes.
And believe me, I want to be an Indian, not a chief. I mean, being a chief is something that they talk about later in life. As you're doing stuff in life, the journey is just about being the real Indian, not about being the leader. I mean,
well, then you have the wisdom and the fortitude to be able to say what you want after that.
I know. Well, people still treat me like with no respect, which is fine by me. I'm the one that's done 25,000-mile races. The Quest will be my 25th, and where all these guys that grew up in Alaska have pretty much done half as much as me. So you tell me who loves what they're doing.
So we are sitting here today inside of Hugh Neff's place, surrounded by a bunch of the team here. Jewel and Amigo and Walter is here, and
your bed
Maestro,
partner.
My bed partner.
Don't tell Michelle.
You know, I know we talked off air, and this is going to be another change in the way that we do your shows. We're going to obviously talk a lot more about how to care for sled dogs, how we are attached to our sled dogs. Tell us Maestro's story. I had no idea he was 16 years old. Tell us about him.
Well, his mother is June Marie, my original leader. She did 11,000 milers. and Earhart dog I got from Curtis Earhart for $100 back in the day when I moved up here in 2000-ish. She was my main leader for my first quest. Maestro's done 11,000 milers as well. He's actually on the old beer label for Lead Dog Ale out of Whitehorse. He's one of the dogs on my team. Just, you know, special dog, not a leader, just a nice solid dog. But up until last year, and you have to imagine he's 16 now, up until last year, you know, I trained all my dogs to stand up and hug me and give me a little peck on the cheek. And up until last year, this 15-year-old dog was up there trying to stand up and kiss me. And it's tough to watch dogs get old, but it's cool, too. I mean, for me, mushing ain't about how many races some guys won. The guys with the money and the clout should be winning these things, and they have the universities that are backing them and the military or whoever. They should be winning these things. For me, it's about my dogs and their quality of life. And when I got a dog like Maestro, who's 16, and I got Oscar out there, who's 13, and a bunch of other old-timers, boys and girls, and I got some neighbors with some of my retired ones. And Walter's looking over here like, I'm only 10, and people are calling me old. But that, for me, is what it's about. It's about quality of life, is what I call it. It's about the respect you as a human being have for your dogs, and you give them what they deserve, more than just what they do for you in a race, but every day in your kennel. There's a lot of people who are winners in my mind that are coming in 30th place in the Iditarod, but love their dogs every day and treat them with the respect they deserve. A lot of people, though, in this sport, you know, there's 70 teams. Everybody has their different perspective. A lot of these people look at dogs in a different way. It's more of a money maker. How many teams can I sign up for a race, and what can I charge each tourist? So even though we don't necessarily compete in the race, we're going to make $30,000 off of a 300-mile race, which I don't agree with at all. I don't think that's what dog racing is about. I think it's about people like myself who came up here with $200 to my name and you know, had a dream and just went for it. I think we're getting to the point in dog mushing, unfortunately, where a select few people have turned this into a tourism sport in some respects and are making lots of money off of it.
A leasing sport, not necessarily a touring sport. Because a touring sport, when people hear that, they think about coming out and going for rides versus a leased team sport.
And that's where, you know, the CBs a few years back wanted to have two divisions in Iditarod. There was going to be the professional division and the adventure division. And the way things are happening right now, I'm a big backer of that because I don't think, you know, that's what, you know, Colonel Norman Vaughn started the serum run for and stuff like that. For me, it's just tough to see kids, like your Kinect 200 filled up in, what, a half hour?
38 minutes.
And you got people in that race with four teams or whatever. I can see two teams, maybe three. I know Ray Reddington's got a bunch of guys doing Iditarod this year that are actually kids that have been working for him that deserve it. But when you get rich people from around the world giving a guy twice as much money a year as the winner of the Iditarod gets to set them up with a team, that's not Joe Reddington's dream. I mean, I know Joe Reddington rented out dog teams too, but When the youngsters and the people that are working their butts off to just get to the starting line don't have a chance to even sign up for the race, that's an issue. What's going on, Jewel?
So as you can hear, we have definitely a dog house here, and I think that's definitely part of this whole experience. So let's switch gears a little bit, Hugh, here on our show. You wanted to talk about sort of the run travel schedule that you're doing this year. You know, I know that a lot of people say, what's this guy doing? He's always out and about. But you're getting your time in on the sled, aren't you?
Yeah, it's funny when I post anything. I'm pretty much going off Facebook. I'm just sick of, you know, there's a lot of great people, but there's lots of negative people too. And that's not what my world's about. So basically my game plan, and I've been doing this for years now, is I run them every day, and I learned this from Lance back in the day. I run them for about 3 weeks straight every day. I'm not going that far. We're just mixing it up. What are you doing, Jill? She's got a fur ball up her nose.
Yeah.
But anyhow, so I run them for, you know, 20 days, I'd say. And then each month I go travel somewhere to make money. I make more money off my mouth than racing. And I love it because I get to give people in Utah or Oregon, where I'm going on my next trip, or over in England and Germany, a face to put with the internet, with the video. I wish more mushers would get out there and travel and spread the word of Joe, is what I call it. And it's just talking about Alaska, about dogs, about how work is a good word, about being tired every day from doing chores is a good thing. The whole video thing is okay, but you got to get out there and see the world. And I love the wilderness. Wherever I go, I might fly into Frankfurt or whatever, but I always ask my local tour guide, where's the local forest? Let's go for a walk.
So we have about 6 minutes left here on the show, Hugh. What else is happening? I know when we talked before the show, and obviously last night, it's not going to be a lot of local races this year for you. It's not going to be the Copper Basins and all that. You're going to focus primarily on?
Kobuk 440 and those other two races. What are they called? Oh, the Quest and the Iditarod.
The Quest and Iditarod.
I'd like to sort of not talk down these races, but I think sometimes some of these races get a little too high on their horses, and they've got to realize that every dog race is awesome, and no race should be any better than any other dog race. They should all be special in their own unique way. So I'm not going to be doing a lot of the shorter races, just because I think the run to Dawson is going to be a good workout for these dogs. I'm trying to, peak them at the right moment. Don't want to be pushing them too hard too early in the year. I think also primarily these 300 and 200 mile races, even though they're races and there's money in them, they should be for newer mushers that are trying to qualify for Iditarod and Quest. And if we want this sport to stay around and to grow, we've got to make sure that people that are trying to enter the races have a chance to qualify.
Well, you're going to have, at some point, there's going to be a tip in the scale where some of the older guys aren't going to be able to do it anymore for one reason or another. And if you don't have the coming up people, what's going to happen?
Difference is back in the day, Joe Reddington, Dick Mackey, Dave Olson, all those guys were Mark Nordman, he's been doing it for years. It's his job also, I guess, so it's a little bit different. But those guys were volunteering and putting in their time to say, you know what, I'm giving back to what's given to me. And, Jeff King donated quite a bit of money back in the day, and Jeff's put on some races. There's a lot of mushers, that need to realize, it's not about my last name. It's about how lucky I am to have my last name, and why don't we as a family try to give back to the sport in some way. And she's just a sneezing machine.
Definitely a hairball.
I don't think she likes the heat in here.
Jewel, hold on tight. But that's a big part of my deal, and why I prefer to go out and do the village races is those kids that are just trying to qualify typically don't go out to the more far-flung races. And plus, I'm a native wannabe anyways, but it's something that needs to be addressed. And I have nothing against people doing tourism, but when you're putting four teams in a race every year, and there's a waiting line within, 30 minutes?
Well, the Kinnick 200, which is really the first qualifying race of the year, it's the first weekend of January, within an hour, 40 musher slots filled up and 19 wait list. That poor person at number 59 does not have a chance. I don't know who that is. But if he is a rookie or whatever, he signed up before an hour was up,
yeah.
Within an hour. But back in the day, you sent your entries in, and it might be a month before you even found out if you were in the race. And nowadays, everything is so full, so quick, even the Quest 300 filled up in a matter of a few days.
The sad thing is a third of those people will drop out, and then all of a sudden they're going to be low on numbers at the start of the race, but the people that want to do it, they're already out of it. So
right.
It's too late.
Right.
So... what are you going to do about it?
Yeah, what are you going to do? So we're going to end the show here in just a second. But before that, tell us about your upcoming tour here in a couple of weeks. I know we mentioned it briefly, heading off towards Utah and Oregon. When is that happening? Where are you going to be?
Where am I going to be? I think it's Redmond, Oregon. I'm actually flying in to meet my cousin Rick. I haven't seen in quite a while. And we're going to do some hiking in Mount Rainier, get a little workout in for a couple of days, see his family. Then Henning Bartel and the folks from Oregon are setting up a show that I'll be doing with Brent Sass and Mike Ellis.
Where's that at?
I believe it's outside of Redmond, Oregon.
Okay.
And then from there, my buddy Neil Bolin, who's planning on doing the Quest and Iditarod, hopefully, in the future, is going to be driving me with him back to Utah, where he lives, and I'll be doing some talks in Park City.
Park City. That's the right around where they did the Olympics, although the skiing events were down in Park City.
Yeah.
So very, very nice snow country down there.
And, before we head out, Robert, I just want to say a quick hello to all my Scandinavian friends as well. You know, Mats Pedersen's signed up to do the Iditarod again, and I just want to remind all my Norwegian friends that I came and did the Finnmark Slope 2 years ago, and none of you, as of yet, have signed up to do the Quest like you all had said you were going to. So if any of you guys are interested in borrowing some dogs or doing the Quest, let me know. I already know for next year, Turi Albertsen from Tromsø, Norway, has already talked to me about possibly using a team for the Yukon Quest. As any dog musher, competition is fun, but at heart, dog mushing is really about the dogs and exploring new places. For me, at least.
There you go. So, Hugh Neff here at Laughing Eyes Kennel in Tok, Alaska. I know you're heading out the rest of the day. I'm heading home in just a little bit. But you're going to continue to run these dogs while you have the snow, anyway.
Yeah. Well, what do we say, 26 degrees here?
Yeah, when we start out.
So, you know, loaded down sled. We're just doing either 7 to 15-mile runs every day.
8 dogs. That's key.
Yeah. And it's just consistency, good habits. Knowing where you can stop the team and hook down and all that sort of stuff. And makes a nice, quiet dog yard at night. You pulled in last night, and was it quiet or what?
I pulled in at 9:30, and I didn't even know I was at a musher's place.
Yeah.
It was quiet.
Yeah.
So very nice. Hugh, it's been a pleasure. Thanks a lot. We'll talk to you guys next time. Goodbye.